It is the Locked On Bengals podcast with your hosts, Joe Goodberry and Jake Lisco. Find us on Twitter at Joe Goodberry and at Jake_NFL. Please like, subscribe, and share as we try to grow this community and pump out daily Bengals content just for you.
Hey there, Bengals fans, and welcome into another episode of the Locked On Bengals podcast. Today, we welcome on a special guest to talk about all things related to the salary cap, including what extensions for AJ Green and Tyler Boyd might look like, why the Bengals manage the cap the way they do, how that compares to the rest of the NFL, and a look ahead at what might be the sticking points in the CBA. I also wanted to give you a quick reminder that, of course, Mailbag Weekend is coming up. And take this opportunity to find the tweet on the Locked On Bengals account. Reply to it with your question. And as we did last week, the winner of the quote-unquote best question prize will get to pick the theme music for next week's mailbag. So, without further ado, welcome on to the podcast, the cap expert, the CBA guy, the one with whom we will talk money. We've been talking this up for, I think, a couple weeks now, Joe.
Yeah.
It's Andre Parada here. Andre, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me. Thanks, Jake. Thanks, Joe. It's been a long time coming, but I appreciate the time.
And if you don't follow Andre on Twitter, you can at Andre Parada 13. That's two R's, two T's in the last name. Andre is a guy who, if there's a contract that comes out and you don't understand part of it, or if you have a question about the Bengals cap or cash or whatever it is about the Bengals finances, you could probably ask Andre and he'll have thoughts, an opinion, facts, whatever it is. He's your go-to guy on Bengals Twitter for this sort of thing. So Andre, before we get into some of the minutia around the cap and the Bengals signing this offseason, how did you get into the Bengals? Are you a Cincinnati guy? How did you get into the cap stuff so closely? I know you're a lawyer, so I'm assuming that has something to do with it, but I'll let you talk for a little bit.
Sure. So I'm a Cincinnati native, born and raised. I remember watching the Super Bowl, the 88 Super Bowl, or the Super Bowl played in January of 89. I was in first grade. That was one of the first times I remember crying after a sporting event. It's when Montana hit John Taylor in the back of the end zone, I still held out hope because there were 34 seconds left in the game. But that was my first. I mean, I had been a fan of the team for the years prior to that, but that has always stuck with me, that Super Bowl loss. I was actually born, dating myself here, in the early 80s. I was born the year of their first Super Bowl. So I like to think that that coincided with, some good fortune for our beloved Bengals. I obviously don't remember that.
Yeah, I was an 88 baby too, so we got both years covered on this podcast today
for sure. Yeah, so I don't remember that the Super Bowl played after the 81 season that was up in Pontiac, Michigan, but I do vividly remember being a first grader in the 88 Super Bowl. But born and raised in Cincinnati kid. I don't live in the area anymore. I live in Michigan with my, it's where my wife's from. So, but I've always followed the Bengals. I follow them closely through the horrible 90s decade, the lost decade, so to speak. And then during the resurgence of, led by Marvin Lewis, who obviously is just has just left after 16 seasons at the helm. But he obviously restored, as you guys know, some credibility back in the franchise. So I've been a Bengals fan for better or worse, diehard, ever since, I can remember. A fan, obviously, of the NFL in general, but specifically of the Bengals. They've always been my team and always will be my team. But to answer your question about how I got into the cap, it really started during the lockout of 2011. There were just a lot of legal issues involved. I mean, the owners were locking out the players, the union decertified. And as an attorney, as you mentioned, I'm a corporate transaction attorney in private practice. It just kind of piqued my interest in the business and legal aspects of the way a sports league is run. and all the legal issues that go into play when you're contracting with highly skilled employees that are NFL players. And so I really started paying attention to the ins and outs of the new terms of the CBA. And then with that, within the CBA, I really started paying attention to the salary cap provisions in there, specifically Section 13, not to get too specific, but really salary cap and player contract evaluation, player contract evaluations, how they're broken down, how they're treated, you know, the whole issue with cap and cash, which I think we'll discuss later on. But that really piqued my interest. So it's almost a decade ago, because again, I've always been a fan. Always been a fan of the draft. Obviously, since the dawn of free agency, the Bengals obviously have never been a major player. So the draft was our free agency, and obviously that's how you build a team. But the draft is Christmas for any fan, really, and particularly Bengals fans, as Joe and Jake, you guys well know. So really, in 2011, when you know the CBA, the new CBA was ratified, it's hard to believe that it's after next season. It's already going to expire. But that's really what started my interest in learning the intricacies of both the CBA in general and then player contracts and team salary caps in specific.
Gotcha. So before I let Joe ask you a question real quick for all of our Cincinnati listeners, the only thing that Cincinnatians care about is where'd you go to high school?
I went to St. Xavier High School. I went to St. X. But I'm also a Bearcat. I'm a graduate. I went to undergrad at the University of Cincinnati. So big Bearcat fan. But I went to St. X High School. So
GCL guy. I was a GNC guy.
Okay. All right.
All right, Joe. Let's get into some Bengals talk.
Well, at first I wanted to bring up the first time Andre and I ever interacted, and it was on Cincy Jungle in the comments section, and I believe we were talking about Cordy Glenn. So this is the 2012 draft coming out of Georgia. And the question with Cordy Glenn at the time was, is he athletic enough to play tackle? And in my opinion, he was not. So It's kind of funny because as the internet goes, and especially now, I think it's definitely more prevalent, but Andre and I went at each other a little bit on whether or not we knew what the other guy was talking about. And we kind of had a bet. And Andre, you remember this, and we've talked about it recently, but I think it's funny now for listeners because it came full circle that Cordy Glenn ends up on the Bengals last year. And I think we rekindled this last year, and you said you owe me a dinner. I feel like I owe you one because I was also wrong as you were wrong. But the argument was that you said he's going to go in the first round. You're like, he's a first-round pick. So your evaluation, I think, was correct. Mine was incorrect. I said he is a guard, and because of that, he's not going to go in the first round. Now, I was correct. He went in the second round. So that is that was the argument, right? It's like, he probably should have gone in the first round in retrospect, but he did play tackle his whole career, so I give you credit for that. You were correct about Cordy Glenn.
Well, like you said, Joe, that was our first interaction, and obviously to any draft analysis and evaluations, I defer to you. Obviously, you're the draft expert, but I just felt strongly about Cordy. I know he played a bunch of positions when he was in college. I think he played four of the five. I think he played every position except center, or he didn't play right tackle or something, but I was pretty adamant. I thought he projected well as a tackle. I think actually, just based on what I saw last year, he looks – you know, just speaking in his current form, he looks a little heavier. Yeah. I think he can stand to lose a little weight. I mean, you guys would talk about that more eloquently than I could, but I did think he had the ability to play tackle. Those big, long arms. He actually had a good combine. He was pretty athletic. If I remember, his athletic testing numbers were pretty good for his size.
He's weight adjusted.
But you're right. We were kind of both right and both wrong. I mean, you were right in the sense he didn't end up being a first round pick. He went, I think, at pick 42 or 41, in the lower 40s. But obviously, he's played tackle his entire career. And if he shakes this little injury bug that he's had the last couple seasons, I actually think maybe eventually, you could speak to, he may get kicked inside the guard eventually down the line.
Sure.
Maybe not with the Bengals, too, but just to extend his career. But, it's exactly how I remember the situation unfolding prior to the 2012 draft, that's for sure.
That conversation always stuck out with me, though, because it was a good lesson in terms of not judging people before you really let them make their case and let it fall out. And in my opinion, ever since then, we've had a really good relationship. We've talked a lot. And, you know, I know you are great at what you know. You defer to me when it's something that should be in my wheelhouse, and it's a great relationship. And I'm glad you're here to join us today.
I wouldn't miss it. It should have happened much sooner, so I appreciate you guys having me on.
Before real quick we get too far into the cap, while you're talking about the draft, you guys met talking about a draft prospect in 2012. Andre, who are your top five targets for the Bengals at 11. I'm going to put you on the spot. Maybe only do three if you only got three, but tell us about your favorite players at the top of the draft here for the Bengals in 2019.
I mean, I just look at it from a value perspective. I'm really high on Dwayne Haskins. I'm not sure if he'll make it to 11, but if he's there, I think strong consideration's got to be given to him. I've obviously follow you guys well on Twitter, and Joe, you've spoken to this, that it plays break down a little bit and he has to go off script. If they're not as designed as the play call calls for, you know, that's where he kind of struggles. I'm not sure if that's correctable. I mean, I'm assuming you can improve on that, especially since he's really only had 1 year as a starter, but I do think the potential for him is quite high. And especially just when you think of how valuable it is to have a rookie or a quarterback on a rookie deal. You have 4 years of cheap labor, essentially. You'll have the fifth-year option. And if the Bengals get him at 11, you actually – the fifth-year option ends up being a little cheaper. Mm-hmm. The Texans will realize this with Deshaun Watson, who I think was picked 11, and Mahomes – I think was the 10th pick, so it won't apply
Mahomes to him. 10, Watson 12.
Or Watson 12, you're right. So Watson's outside of the top 10. So the reason that's important for the fifth-year option is that fifth-year option is calculated the salary is calculated as the average between the third and 25th highest-paid player in that position. So the quarterback position is obviously the most heavily compensated, so that number will still be high, but it will be much less than if the player is picked in the top 10. That average salary is essentially the transition tag number. It's salaries 1 through 10. So that's important. But to answer your question, Jake, I think Dwayne Haskins has got to be given strong consideration. And then just in terms of overall talent and need, although I hate drafting for need, especially in the first round, I think Devin White has the ability to be a tremendously impactful linebacker. I think the guy can do it all. By no means is he a sure prospect. I don't really think anybody is, for that matter. But he's something, just based on his talent and the need for the team, that – it would just provide just that much-needed athleticism at the linebacker unit that they sorely lack. I mean, they've re-signed Preston Brown. He's committed to losing weight, I guess, a little bit. I'm not sure if that will it help your athleticism, so to speak. It's great if you drop some pounds, but you really can't change your short area quickness and your long speed that much, I don't think, even dropping a couple pounds. I mean, unless he has like a Le'Veon Bell type of body transformation, I just don't see it. I mean, I hope he does, but we need – the Bengals need more athleticism at the linebacker position. So I'd go Haskins, Dwayne White. I think Devin Bush, too, has got to be given consideration. He's undersized. Obviously, I've seen him a lot here in Michigan. I've attended some of their games. Some family members have season tickets to Michigan football. He's a great player. He has NFL bloodlines. His father played in the league. I think scouts and teams like that for some reason. Yeah. They like that aspect. So if I had to put him in order, I'd go Haskins, White, Devin Bush. I always think offensive line, you can't have too many. And so we'll talk about the Bobby Hart signing, but I think Jonah Williams and maybe even Cody Ford to round out the top five. I think both of those guys will likely be there. Haskins may or may not be. Devin White, you know, Tampa may select him. Detroit, even picking at 8, may select him, even though they picked Jared Davis a couple years ago at the linebacker spot. But I would go Haskins, White, Bush, Jonah Williams, and Cody Ford, if you had to put me on the spot.
I think that's a fair five to target. But before they get there, or maybe impacting their draft, especially need at wide receiver, with A.J. Green and Tyler Boyd entering the final year of their deal, how do you see that playing out, and what could you see numbers-wise for an extension for either one of those guys?
Sure. I think they'll both be Bengals. Obviously, they'll be Bengals this coming year, and I think the Bengals will lock them up. I think they'll both sign extensions this offseason. I think AJ's extension is all but a formality at this point. I mean, people can debate, you know, he's entering what will be his age 31 season this year. He's born in 88. I think his birthday's late July, so he'll turn 31 at the start of training camp. So this will be his age 31 season. Julio Jones has been rumored to be on the verge of a new extension that's probably going to be at or exceeding the $20 million a year range.
Does that sound crazy to you?
Not really. I mean, okay. If you look at it in a vacuum, it just as a whole number, $20 million for a receiver, everything else, my God, that's an outlandish number. But if you look at it as a percentage of the cap, it's really not that bad. I mean, AJ, his last extension after his rookie season was in 2015. I think it was right before they boarded the plane to play in Oakland. And he signed a four-year, $60 million extension, which is $15 million AAV. At the time, the cap was $143 million, the unadjusted cap. So as a percentage of the cap, $20 million is right at the same percentage as $15 million was back in 2015. So if you look at it from that metric as a percentage of the cap, it's really not that outlandish. Now, ultimately, is there risk involved? Of course. I mean, are these nagging toe injuries going to come back to bite him and bite the club in turn, potentially? That's always a risk. But I think based on Mike Brown's comments in Arizona at the owners meeting, I really don't think they're going to have much second thought, if any, about extending A.J. Green. He's a Hall of Fame player. The Bengals have one Hall of Fame player. They should have more, I think. But Munoz is their only current one. I really think that means something to the Bengals. I mean, regardless, I know we're not talking about just on-field talent necessarily. Those are ancillary issues. But I think that is important to Mike Brown and the Bengals as a whole.
Yeah, I think we took that the same way Jake and I did after those comments.
Yeah, I mean, if he's productive, and you know, Andy Dalton's been a serviceable, at times better than serviceable quarterback. But if AJ were paired with a truly an elite passer, a guy with a plus-plus arm, I mean, you could see his production and his ability even flourish even more than what it currently is. And again, he's on a Hall of Fame trajectory. So I think Julio Jones' deal will probably get done soon, and probably before AJ. And AJ and his agent, I think they may have the same representative. I'm not sure. But AJ's never been a guy to say, you know, I want to be the highest paid player at my position. But I think he'll hold out for a good deal. And I think the Bengals, though, won't really hesitate to give it to him. So I'm looking at, to answer your question specifically, I'd look at a four-year, $80 million extension. And so what he's making now, he's scheduled to make just over $12 million between his base salary and his workout bonus. Not his cap. His cash hit this year is going to be over $12 million. And so if you bump that up a little bit, it's really not that much that you're adding to him just this year too, just to get him to sign that deal. Mm-hmm. And the way you can do it, in fact, I'll post this on Twitter later this week or this weekend. I've come up with the actual structural breakdown of a proposed contract, which is yearly cap hit and cash spends. And if you assume that the cap is going to continue to increase at least $10 million, but let's say it does. Let's say it increases $8 million a year for the next couple of years, you know, and you keep the cap hits pretty consistent. As a percentage of the cap, that $20 million APY is still going to be very reasonable, especially for an elite player. Again, you can argue about the value of a receiver and allocating those resources elsewhere. Obviously, that's a fair argument. But I just don't see them letting A.J. Green walk. I even don't see them letting him play out this year and tagging him next year. Because if he does go this year playing on this final year of his deal, they're not going to let him hit the open market. They will franchise him next year. So in order to avoid that, because it potentially does get messy too when that happens, I don't even say bite the bullet. I think they're happy to extend him. And I think four-year, $80 million extension, which would make the terms of the deal actually 5 years and a little over $92 million. So if you take what's called the paper money, as other more eloquent cap experts on Twitter say, it would end up being about a $92 million deal over 5 years, because you're including the year he's currently under contract. And that averages out to just over $18.4 million. So I think that's the sweet spot. 4 years, $80 million extension, that puts him through his age 35 season. But the way AJ's conducting himself, minus these nagging injuries, he's in incredible shape. He takes care of his body. And with sports science now, that aging may not be that concerning. So I see that type of deal getting done this offseason. And it probably gets done either before training camp or definitely before the start of the regular season.
And so you mentioned that you think that he takes care of himself well. He's been in good shape. He has had injuries the last few seasons, yep. And there's not a great track record for receivers in their 30s continuing to perform at a, let's say, Pro Bowl level, even though the Pro Bowl is a popularity contest. And AJ will probably still go, even if he's not necessarily playing at that level for the next few years. Do you think that a four-year extension is a wise move, or do you think it's just a move that will happen and it'll be well-received, I think? AJ is very popular, but do you think it's a wise move for a football team from a business, from a team-building perspective?
That's a great question. I mean, if we're looking at it from the perspective of a team like the New England Patriots, they would never consider – I wouldn't say never, but they would strongly consider not extending him at those terms, precisely for the reasons you mentioned, Jake. The sustainability of a receiver into their 30s. AJ with a four-year extension would be playing into his age 35 season. So a team like the Patriots would never do that. I mean, you just probably wouldn't see it. But their whole philosophy, too, is they never really relied on that type of receiver, too. I mean, they've had Gronkowski I guess, retired unofficially. He hasn't submitted his paperwork. So they do have good receiving threats, regardless of their tight end or receiver. But they got him on a great deal. They extended him when you could prior to the new CBA. You didn't have to wait 3 years. So they extended him very early and got incredible value from a Hall of Fame player. So is it wise? I could see it either way. I mean, are there teams are there successful teams that would consider not doing that? Absolutely. I mean, I mentioned the Patriots as this one, but I don't necessarily, because the cap is not stagnant and because there are other CBA constraints, you have to spend this money. You have to spend at a certain percentage of the cap. Who else are you going to spend it on for the Bengals? And they whiffed on the 14 draft. They've whiffed on the 15 draft that you guys have talked about. 16 looks pretty promising, but I mean, who are you going to give a lot of money to? Joe Mixon? He's a running back. If anything, and I like Joe Mixon as a player, if anything, I'd be against extending Joe Mixon.
We've talked about that also.
As callous as it sounds, I'd run Joe Mixon in the ground the next 2 years. and I mean, pretty much what the Steelers try to do with Le'Veon. And that's, I want Joe Mixon around, but you can make a stronger argument that, and I think the Bengals will eventually extend Joe Mixon is my point. And I wouldn't necessarily see the value in that, not necessarily because of Joe Mixon, of who he is, but just because of the position he plays. So I hate to sit on the fence on this question, but it really is a $1 million question, a player like A.J. Green. But look at the Falcons, right? The Falcons have a quarterback in Matt Ryan who's ostensibly a little better than Andy Dalton. He is better. He had an MVP season. They've made the Super Bowl. They should have won that Super Bowl. They're up 28-3, and the Falcons are not going to hesitate to extend Julio Jones. I think Julio is a year or two younger than AJ because he came out, I think, after junior year. I don't know if that's true, but I think he may be a year younger. So they are going to extend him. They will extend him. And they may do a 5-year extension for Julio.
And to think about also, the Falcons have invested at wide receiver also with signing Mohamed Sanu, drafting Calvin Ridley last year. So similar situation to the Bengals, drafting John Ross in the first round, and now they have to pay their slot guy. So who are they going to spend that money on? Tyler Boyd. What do you think for Tyler Boyd?
Yeah, I see Boyd getting extended too. But the way to get Boyd under an extension, you have to really sweeten the pot, because if you're Boyd and his agent, you're saying, you know, I'll play out this season and I'll hit the open market. And there's no way, even if they re-sign AJ Green, there's no way the Bengals will tag Tyler Boyd. I don't see it unless he explodes for like a 1,400-yard season and you know 12 touchdowns is just incredible. And maybe AJ gets hurt this year and Tyler really establishes himself as the go-to guy. They won't tag him if they don't sign him, especially considering that we'll likely have signed Green. So you really got to sweeten that deal in the sense that you really got to give Tyler a lot of cash this year to entice him to forego getting on the open market next year. So for Boyd, if you look at the guys on the open market, the slot receiver receivers that signed last month, you got Adam Humphries with the Titans, signed a 4-year, $36 million deal. That's $9 million a year. Cole Beasley signed for 29 in Buffalo. That's $7.5 million. But Boyd is, I'd say, a better player. He's younger than those guys, and I think he's a better player. So him and his agents are going to say, look, we can go to the open market next year, and if you account for the increase in cap that's likely to occur, you know, Tyler is going to get 10 or 11, if not more, on the open market. And so I think a deal – you know, honestly, it's gonna cost a little bit to get Tyler Boyd, but I would say, I like the 4-year deals, and it looks like the Bengals too. Kind of, that's a sweet spot for these extensions. So I think a 4-year, anywhere between $40 million and $44 million in new money average, that's $10 to $11 million AAV. I think that gets it with really strong cash in year one, because Tyler's only making, in the relative world of NFL football players, he's making $1 million this year. I think he's making
right.
1.3 is his cap number. I think a little over 1 is his cash.
So it'd be a nice pay raise for him.
Absolutely. So that's security for him. And obviously the way the Bengals, they don't guarantee base salaries. They guarantee the signing bonus, and that's about it. But the way they structure their contracts, they have what I call effective guarantees, where they're really not going to cut a guy after 2 years, probably even after 3. So you can pretty much call that money, that those 2 to 3 year cash flows, as guarantees. But I see a 4-year, honestly, if you're going to get Tyler, if you're serious about getting Boyd in the fold and you don't want to mess around and nickel and dime him and his agent, you got to present him maybe with a 4-year, $40 million deal, but then willing to go up to about 4-year, $44 million. And that's $11 million AAV. That's a lot of investment, obviously, in the wide receiver group. And then you got John Ross,
exactly,
who still has a lot to prove, but I think with this new offense, he'll do well. So that's a lot of money. Jake, to your point about how wise is it to invest in a single player in AJ Green, who's going to into his 30s, you could certainly make the argument, how wise is it to invest in that one position group, because it's going to be expensive. But if you look at it as a percentage of the cap, the numbers are still pretty reasonable. In terms of, if you take their combined cap hits, you're still spending, you'd probably be at around maybe 17% of the cap though in just two guys. And that's a lot, but
those Ross guys, has a decent cap hit also.
He still does.
Obviously being the ninth pick. And I was going to get to that as overspending. We talk about positional cap a lot, and I'm glad you just rolled right into overspending, especially at one position. Receiver seems like the one you don't see a lot of teams do that, or at least the successful teams spend at wide receiver. The Bengals almost have no choice but to.
Yeah, right now, just before we answer that question, the Browns have the highest cap hits for their wide receivers in 2019 because of obviously the Odell Beckham trade, $36 million for all of their receivers. So if you're giving Boyd $10 or $11 million and AJ $20 million, if those are the cap hits, which they aren't necessarily the cap hits because the cap hit is not always the same as the cash. We will get into that in a bit. Those two guys alone would be fourth in the NFL this year. Sorry, fifth, right behind the Eagles, who are $31.6 million for their wide receiver core.
And then adding in John Ross and what he makes, that puts them probably near the top.
And the bottom of the roster guys, for sure. Because you said AJ's at 12 this year and Tyler Boyd's at about one. So that in the cash. Bengals. Okay. Well, the Bengals' current cap number is 26. So if you add roughly 18 to that, that's first place by some distance.
Right. And the Browns can get away with doing that because, you know, they can't even touch Mayfield's contract for another 2 years at the earliest.
That's the benefit.
So that's going back to my Haskins thing, too, in terms of my draft desires, so to speak. But you mentioned the Eagles, Jake. That's good. I mean, the Eagles, they beat the Patriots a couple years ago in the Super Bowl, and they don't seem to have any issue. I know they signed Alshon Jeffery to that 1 year deal, and then they extended him after that 1 year.
Such a weird scenario right there, right? Yeah. Have you ever seen that, getting a 1 year deal and then signing him before he even really plays it out?
I give kudos to Howie Roseman. I think the Bengals really are in desperate need of a Howie Roseman type. He is my favorite the executive vice president, football administrator in football, not just because he wins, but the way he structures his contracts and really just maximizes the salary cap. Not everything he does turns out well, but I mean, the proof's in the pudding, so to speak. He maximizes the value of his team and what he does. But I've never kind of seen that arrangement. 1 year deal and then a kind of a nice bump before the season's over, and you just get that. It's like essentially you would have signed him to a 5 year deal to begin with, but it's a unique approach for sure.
I think the other thing to mention with the Browns, too, is that they have more cap room than most teams in the NFL right now. They're actually spending $11.1 million on the quarterback position this year compared to the Bengals at $16.9. So they're only spending, $6 million left on quarterbacks if you're rounding? So, right. I mean, they do have a quarterback on a rookie deal. I think that must be dead money, right?
It has to be.
Or for Tyrod Taylor or
are they still paying for Brock Osweiler?
That's what I was just looking at.
I'm not sure. No, if they let him go last year, his only cap hit would, I think it was pre-June 1, so it would only be accelerated in the 1 year. So I'm not sure if he's still on their cap.
No,
but I don't think
not.
So. But.
I'm actually not sure where they're getting to that high of a number for quarterbacks. I'll try to look at this for a second. Drew Stanton has a $3.7 million cap hit.
There you go.
So actually, that's it. Baker's is $7.5 million, and Drew Stanton's is $3.7 million.
Baker, I mean, that's because Baker was the number one overall pick, so that's close to like a $20 million bonus. You divide that over the 4 years of the deal, that's already $5 million just in bonus allocation, and plus his salary is it jumps it up to $7 million total cap pick because the salary is around two. But, the hope is with Zach Taylor and Brian Callahan, even though Callahan won't be calling the plays – is that this offense kind of explodes. And if if this truly is, as Mike Brown said, you know, an evaluation year for Dalton, before, you know, they're not going to just give him an extension. I would hope not. Then you hope that this offense at least gets the receivers to flourish because they have spent a lot. They've expended a lot of draft capital in that area. And if you got to pay people on offense, you know, you pay those guys because really they're offensive linemen. There's prices on a rookie deal. Glenn is going to be out of a contract after 2020. Bowling after this year. You're not spending it really on the offensive line.
Even though this year, I would say based on who they paid, paying John Miller, paying Bobby Hart, we can get into that. And now I think it's a fair time.
Yeah, I think now is a fair time. We're just going to take a quick break real quick, and then we'll come back. We'll talk about what they're spending on the offensive line. We'll talk about a little bit of general stuff, why the Bengals manage their top 51 cap the way they do, why they always float about $10, $12 million every year, if find out if there's a method to the madness. So we'll be right back.
Welcome back to the Lockdown Bengals podcast. We have Bengals cap expert Andre Parada here. And before we get too deep into some of the signings they made, some of the areas where they spend some of this cap and money, if you could break down the cash versus cap and really explain it to our listeners better than we ever could before we talk specifics on the players.
Sure. Yeah. So that's, I mean, that's a critical, it's a critical distinction that needs to be made. So between what I call a cash spend and what's universally known as the cap hit. So I'll kind of walk you through like maybe a simple example with even a nameless player. We'll just take a simple contract and how it's usually reported in the media and what I think immediately people think of that contract and what the potential cap hits are. So let's just say you have a free agent player who signs a 2-year, $20 million deal. And immediately you think, okay, that averages out to $10 million a year, which that's the average of that contract. And so inevitably people will think, well, that's a $10 million cap hit in year one and a $10 million cap hit in year two. And that may very well be the case, but a lot of teams structure their contracts differently. And the way you get the reason why you get a different cap hit and a cash spend is because of how signing bonuses are treated for cap accounting purposes. So let's take that 2-year, $20 million deal. Let's say that 2-year, $20 million deal includes a $10 million signing bonus. So a lot of people then think, my suspicion is maybe people think that $10 million is added to the $20 million. And it's like they're saying, oh, it's 2 years, $20 million with a $10 million signing bonus. So it's $30 million. But signing bonus is always part of the total. So let's take 2 years, $20 million. That includes a $10 million signing bonus. So because it's 2 years, the way signing bonuses are treated, you prorate them. You divide them equally over the years of the contract, maximum for 5 years. So if it's a 6-year contract, you can only divide it over five. But for our purposes, the 2-year, $20 million deal, you take that $10 million signing bonus and you allocate $5 million of that bonus to year one and $5 million to year two, even though that bonus is literally paid to the player right away. Now, there may be different payment terms where they get half of the bonus now and half in 3 months. But for cap purposes, that bonus is equally divided over the years of the contract. So 2 years, $25 million, or 2 years, $20 million, a $10 million bonus. Let's say then the player has a $1 million base. Let's keep it very simple. $1 million base salary in year one, and then a $9 million base salary in year two. So all those numbers add up, right? You have $10 million bonus. That's 10. $1 million base salary in year one. That's 11. $9 million base salary in year two. That's how you get to the total of $20 million. So now what's the cap spend of let's talk about the cap hit, right? The cap hit is really just an accounting mechanism, how that money is accounted for on the team's cap. So 2 years, $20 million with a $10 million bonus, if you kind of visualize it here, and a $1 million year one base, since that bonus is divided, that $10 million bonus is divided equally over those 2 years, $5 million of that bonus allocation is to year one. You add it to his $1 million base. That player's cap hit is only $6 million for year one. Even though he's been paid $11 million, he gets the $10 million bonus and his $1 million base salary. So the year one cap hit is $6 million. The year one cash spend is $11 million, and that's the $10 million bonus and the $1 million base. But for a cap purposes, how you get the cap hit, you have to divide the signing bonus equally over the terms of the deal. And so a lot of people, I would suspect, see that deal or hear it being reported, 2 years, $20 million. They think $10 million cap hit. They know the average is correct. Whatever it ends up being, just the average is $10 million. But the cap hit may not be $10 million, especially if there's a signing bonus. And so then the year two cap hit would be you have the $9 million base, and then you still have the $5 million bonus allocation for year two. So the year two cap hit is $14 million. So the cap hits always will add up to the overall value of the contract. So year one cap hit is six, year two cap hit is 14. That gets you the 20 million, but it's not 10 and 10 for cap purposes. But also then the year two cash, he didn't get paid the signing bonus in year two. He got paid in year two. He just got paid that $9 million base. So his year two cap is 14, but his year two cash is only 9 million. And so that's the critical distinction between cap and cash. Now, there are a whole host of other things in the CBA. They're called other amounts treated as signing bonus. I won't get too far into that. But for example, there could be a roster bonus that's in the contract if the roster bonus is earned after the final preseason game, for example. So, for example, it could come into play with an AJ Green extension. The Bengals could say, here's a $5 million roster bonus. But if that bonus is earned after preseason game number four this year, that roster bonus will be allocated just like a signing bonus, even though it's technically a roster bonus. But I won't get too far into that stuff. So to use that simple example, two-year $20 million deal with a $10 million signing bonus and a $1 million base salary, that player has a cash spend of $11 million. Gets the $10 million bonus and a $1 million in cash. That's his cash that he earns. But for the cap, how that money is allocated for the team salary cap, you take the $10 million and divide it by two because that's the length of the contract. That's $5 million. And then you add his $1 million base. That's how you get the $6 million cap hit for that player. Even though people looking at it or hearing about that deal think, oh, his cap hit has to be $10 million because it's 2 years, $20 million. It may be the case if there's no signing bonus. If you just pay the guy $10 million in base year one and $10 million in base in year two, and that's a $10 million cap hit and cash spend. But that's how you get
I was going to say, how do the Bengals structure it? Are they different than everyone else? Because it normally seems like when I'm looking at it, their cap hits are normally pretty flat throughout the life of the contract.
Yeah, they're pretty consistent. They like to keep the cap hit and cash spends pretty straight, pretty equal, essentially. It's called like a one-to-one cap to cash ratio. They like to achieve that, although that's not always the case. I mean, with an AJ extension, I foresee some of the cash to be much higher, especially in year one, than the cap, because they'll probably give him a big bonus. But to your point, Joe, you're right. Most of the guys that they've signed to free agent deals, whether they're retained free agents like Bobby Hart or an outside free agent on a multi-year deal like John Miller, the Bengals' typical contract structure in those deals includes a modest signing bonus, followed by a year one roster bonus, followed by an offseason year two roster bonus. So I think that the Bobby Hart deal had a $3 million bonus, right? A signing bonus. So it's a three-year deal. That $3 million, $1 million gets allocated to each of those years, 2019, 2020, 2021. But he got a $3 million check. He got a $3 million signing bonus. So that's his cash in his pocket, $3 million. But for cap purposes, only $1 million is allocated for each of those years. Then I think he also got a $3 million roster bonus, which is cash again to him. And that roster bonus counts immediately against the cap. And then he got, I'm not sure what his base salary was, but I think his cash spend is $7.4 million. And his cap hit is $5.9 million. And the reason the cap hit is lower than the cash is because you have that salary bonus allocation in years two and three. And so whenever you have salary bonus allocation in subsequent years, that's what leads the potential for dead money. Because when a player is cut or traded or waived, any amount of that bonus that has not been accounted for on the cap immediately accelerates onto the team's cap once that player is removed from the roster. They call it dead money because it's money that counts against the cap, even though it's already been paid to the player, but it's not hit or been accounted for on the team's cap. And the way you get that is because of the signing bonus allocation. Because the signing bonuses are allocated over the life of the contract, you have some bonus money. Again, it's money that's already been paid, but you have some bonus money for cap purposes that have not been accounted for on the team's cap. And so when you remove that player from the roster, either via trade or waiving the player or cutting the player outright, that bonus money needs to then count against the cap. So they call it accelerates against the team's cap. If that transaction happens before June 1, all of the future year bonus money, the current and future year bonus money allocation, immediately accelerates onto the team cap. If the transaction occurs after June 1 and there are futures remaining on the contract, and there are they're in those future years, there's a signing bonus allocation. The signing bonus allocation for the current year counts against the team's cap, and then the future year allocations count against the team's cap next year. The Bengals notoriously don't like to do post-June 1 transactions because they like, if they're going to bite the bullet, which they at least the last couple years, they lead the league in having the least amount of dead money. But I guess their thinking is, and I tend to agree with it, if you're going to bite the bullet on dead money, you might as well just bite it, just, you know, take a bite of the apple now and get it over with. But other teams handle it differently. They'll say they really don't mind. And you can actually denote a player as being a post-June 1 cut, even though the cut happens before June 1. You're allowed to do that twice a year for two players per team. So you can make the actual cut before June 1, but say I'm gonna assign this as a post-June 1 cut and then take the cap hits due to the bonus acceleration over the current year and then the subsequent year.
So we got the explanation there of cash versus cap, basically everything. That's great, Andre. Hopefully everyone understands that after that. I want your take now then on what I think was the most wasteful signing, what wasteful money, cash this year, $7.4 million. And when the way the Bengals traditionally operate, paying him that money means he's the starter. Even if they draft a guy at the 11th pick, that 11th pick is probably going to make a little bit less cap hit-wise, definitely. But cash-wise, a whole different subject. Yeah. But Bobby Hart, how did you feel about that? Did that really throw you off? I mean, this is not how they've treated subpar tackles in the past.
You're absolutely right, and I've spoken on this. I was outspoken on Twitter and just speaking with you guys off the record, so to speak. I mean, it was truly baffling. And I know team executives have mentioned they've kind of seemingly been defensive a little bit about it, but you know they've heard the fan uproar. But it's justifiable. I mean, there's really no way. I really think that they misevaluated what Bobby Hart's market would have been. The Bengals reportedly just had a player of similar caliber as
Jordan Mills.
Jordan Mills in house for a visit over this week. The fact that Jordan Mills is still on the market very likely tells you that Bobby Hart would have likely been on the market at this point too. But to put it in perspective, Joe and Jake, Bobby Hart last year, or prior to signing with the Bengals in 2018, Bobby Hart was a seventh round pick of the New York Giants, and he essentially quit on his team. I mean, you talk to some Giant players, he was dogging it, and they cut him. And they signed him. I think they signed him before scouting combine last year. And it was a very modest deal. It was a true prove it deal. There was nothing given to him. And to Bobby's credit, there wasn't much competition, but he earned the job last year, but it was on a 1 year, $1.05 million deal. And we all know how Bobby Hart played. This is, again, nothing against Bobby Hart as a person. He didn't give himself that deal. I'm happy for Bobby Hart as a person. He didn't negotiate. He didn't give himself that deal. I mean, if somebody offers you that deal, you run to sign it. But he was playing on slightly over $1 million last year. In no way could you objectively say that his play warranted essentially a seven-fold increase in salary from his play last year. I mean, regardless of the penalties, regardless if Coach Jim Turner thinks the penalties were truly his fault or all his fault, it doesn't matter. If you just objectively look at his play, it was substantially subpar for an offensive tackle. And you know, obviously the Bengals had the 2015 picks, their contracts were up. They were never going to re-sign those guys. Jake Fisher has changed positions now. He's in Buffalo, and boy, he's down in Jacksonville. But look what he signed for. Look at the fact that Jordan Mills is still on the market. Bobby Hart, if you want to bring him back, that's fine. I guess the uproar is it's not necessarily of, as you know, Troy Blackburn said, or who's going to play? Are you going to pin your hopes on a rookie? It's the issue become it's a value issue, and in no way can you objectively justify a regardless of the 3 years, $16.5 million with the potential to earn 21, no way can you justify paying Bobby Hart $7.4 million next year. You just cannot justify that. Yeah. Regardless of the fact that they had nobody in-house to replace. Look, the Bengals had a situation in 2013 with Andre Smith. And Andre had his struggles his first couple of years, but Andre developed into a sound right tackle. And the Bengals dug their heels in 2013, much like they did with Darquez Dennard just now. They dug their heels in. They said, Andre, go out and test, go on the open market by all means, establish your market. And he didn't find what he liked out there. And he came essentially crawling back to the Bengals. And they signed him at the time to a three-year, $18 million deal.
Day before the draft, right?
Day two of the draft.
Oh, day two of the draft. That's right.
It was the Friday of the draft. It was the day they picked Giovanni Bernard and Marcus Hunt, by the way, because that was day two of the 2013 draft. And he signed that deal. I think Jeff Hobson wrote on Bengals.com that, you know, he was brought into the building and they were looking at the draft board. And the story goes, if you're to believe it, that they were looking at Menelik Watson at Geo's pick, the right tackle out of Florida, who I don't even think is in the league anymore.
No, he's a bum.
So they dug their heels in with an objectively better player at the Andre Smith. You can make the argument, even though Smith is unsigned, that Smith, you know, he's much older than Bobby Hart. But at the time in 2013, you know, Smith was a much better player. And what was the risk there? The risk was having Smith potentially leave and pinning your hopes on Menelik Watson, maybe?
Right.
Because they had nobody behind Andre Smith. And so if you're going to dig your heels in for Andre Smith, and it ended up working out, then why are you rushing? Because that's what it was. This was on the Monday of free agency, technically before free agency started. So Hart was an in-house guy, so you could resign him at any point. You didn't have to wait till Wednesday at 4. But there was no rush. There was no rush to sign a player of Bobby Hart's caliber. Again, and that's speaking no ill will of Bobby Hart. I mean, it's an unjustifiable contract offer. I don't care that you say 3 years, 16.5. I'm not looking 3 years down the road. I'm looking at what you're paying him this year based on what he's done in the past. There is no way to justify that from a cap valuation and player evaluation point. I'm not going to belabor the point, obviously, and you know, it is what it is at this point. I hate that term, but there's nothing you can do about it. But if you're objectively evaluating that contract, the one-year payout, essentially, because he's guaranteed to be on the roster this year, it is a head-scratcher, to say the least. It is baffling, and it's really, quite frankly, unjustifiable.
And the inconsistency part is what really gets me is they play hardball with Darqueze Dennard in the same offseason. Exactly. They failed to play hardball at all with Bobby Hart. And exactly. like you said, we compared, it might have been this podcast, it may have been last week, but when we found out Jordan Mills was coming in, I mean, number-wise, production-wise, he's a very similar player, and he's still here. So even had Bobby Hart's market have been, you know, something out there, no, someone wanted to give him a deal, fine. You let him go because a similar talent player is still there a month later.
Exactly right. One last thing I'll mention on there if I could. You know, if Bobby Hart, kudos to him and his agent for getting that best deal for him, but if Bobby Hart would have come back, like obviously he did, and said, hey, we have a market forming for us, then you have to walk away from that deal. You have to, in no way can you justify, especially the way they play hardball this year with Darqueze Dennard, different position, but a markedly better player than Bobby Hart, as you mentioned, Joe. You have to walk away from that deal. If the deal turns into, we're going to pay him $7.4 million this year after paying him $1 million and change last year, you have to walk away. You no matter what's not in the cupboard behind him, you have to walk away from that deal.
And that's
they've done
great
it before,
point.
Too. They've right. done it with exactly. Marvin Jones and Mohamed exactly. Sanu and Andrew Whitworth and Kevin Zeitler. They've done it with a bunch of guys. They did it with Jonathan Joseph and re-signed Leon Hall instead. They did it to some extent with Mike Johnson when they re-signed Carlos Dunlap instead.
And that's one of the frustrating parts also is that when you – we talk about all the time, we'd like to see the Bengals do more one-year deals and, you know, bring these guys on prove-it deals. The Patriots do it all the time. And instead, the Bengals, they do a one-year deal for Preston Brown and Bobby Hart last year. Those are two of their prove-it guys. What did they prove other than not being able to stay healthy or give you poor play? And then both got raises and extensions. And so you go, man, not only do they not know what a one-year prove-it deal is supposed to return or what it's supposed to look like in order to receive an extension, they went and overpaid, in my opinion, for both players.
But then you can point at Tyler Eifert and say, this is what a one-year prove-it deal should look like, and then they got a better deal this year.
And then Darqueze Dennard do another one-year deal this year.
I wonder if it's different people. I mean, I think Katie Blackburn's doing all the negotiation now, but I wonder if it's different people sometimes, you know?
I think Katie and Troy do the negotiations. I think Duke may do some negotiations as well. But yeah, Katie and Troy, and the reason why the Bobby Hart deal is so shocking is because one thing, and you can question their approach in free agency, but and their cap management, but they tend to get very good value in their deals. They don't overpay. And so from that perspective, if you look at the New England model in that regard, that's commendable. They know what their value is, but they missed. And there's no hiding that fact. And the fact that maybe they're trying to defend it, it makes it even worse because your fan base isn't stupid. And not that they're saying or implying that we are, but a bad deal is a bad deal, and you can call it out when it needs to be called out, and there's no way to paint the Bobby Hart deal other than it being a bad deal. Even if it ends up being a one-year deal, it actually makes it worse if it's a one-year deal, because you're going to end up paying him $7.4 million for just 1 year, and that's laughably bad. It's just bad.
Any of these signings that you do like, though, value-wise?
I like the Eifert signing. Look, Tyler Eifert is owed I think I tweeted it out. He's owed 1,000 years of good health and fortune from the football gods. If that guy could ever stay healthy again, it's not his. He's not. You know, Pro Football Doc is a good follow on Twitter. He hates the term injury prone, but obviously Eifert is. He hasn't played a full season in quite some time. I think maybe since his rookie year. But if he could stay healthy, and if you can limit his packages to red zone and other sub packages like you guys have talked about, I mean, the value is there, especially at $3 million that they signed him for. I do like John Miller. John Miller is a good value signing. That's a good target sign. I mean, Joe, you're up in Buffalo, and obviously the Bills fans were kind of indifferent at best, but maybe even happy to see him go. So, and they signed Quentin Spain today. They signed Morris and Spencer Long, Ty Nitschke is a tackle. They've been signing offensive linemen, and the fact that they let one go kind of may speak to the fact that they didn't really care for him that much, at least to keep him around. But I do like that deal because, one, it is a noticeable upgrade from the current right guard, Redmond. It's an improvement. I think Mike Brown has even mentioned that he's the starter going into the season. John Miller is. And obviously, he's an improvement over Redmond, and the value is there. The value – I had Miller at 3 years and 17 mil or 16.5, that's a good signing to me, especially considering what they had. That's not maybe a slight overpay, but I think the valuation is there. It's a three-year deal. And if he can get some good coaching, I think that's a solid signing. I like Tyler Eifert. I like Darqueze Dennard. I honestly, if you look at my Twitter feed, I had Darqueze Dennard at 5 years and 40-some million, at like a little under $9 million AAV, which I would have been comfortable with, but – 1 year, $4.5 million. Sure, I'll take that for Darqueze Dennard. I think that's a great deal. Yeah, so if they want to dug in their heels, yeah, I'm shocked too. I mean, I think he needs a new agent, but that's a different story. But to kind of tie this all back to the Bobby Hart valuation, if the Bengals would have announced the Bobby Hart extension for the exact same terms, maybe even slightly more, 1 year, 1.5, I don't think anybody would have had an issue with it. Maybe some people would have objected to it, but at that rate, you're saying obviously he's not the starter. And it's another prove-it deal, even though he really didn't prove anything, obviously, last year. I think nobody would object to that. So from a value perspective, I like the Dennard signing. I like Eifert, and I like John Miller because they needed an upgraded right guard, and I think he, at if nothing else, he represents a serious upgrade over Redmond, who started last year.
So let's just do a couple more topics here. First, let's talk about the way the Bengals manage their cap, because I think it's not totally unheard of, but the Bengals, it seems like every year we have Paul Daner and Jeff Hobson telling us they need to keep X dollars available. And we know that in the last 2 years, at least, the Bengals haven't necessarily lived up to that mantra of keeping X dollars available. But for the last 5 years or 4 years, at least, it's been, you know, $14 million, $12 million, $10 million they've had for the whole season beneath the cap, and they've, you know, rolled it over to the next year or whatever you want to say about it, but they haven't used all of their cap every year.
Yeah, so I think it's safe to say that the Bengals take a very conservative approach to the cap, and that's fine. You never really want to be tight against the cap, but really, if you look at it, there's really no such thing as cap hell, because there are ways to get around it. The Steelers take the same approach as the Bengals do with regard to kind of eschewing outside free agency, but they're always tight against the cap. I mean, the Steelers are constantly restructuring and renegotiating deals, and all that does really is you're some more cash to the player, and that in the form of a signing bonus. And to our cash cap discussion earlier, that then does kick the cap can down the road because that signing bonus money gets prorated. So the Steelers are constantly in what is termed as cap hell, but the way you get out of that is you just kind of pump more cash into it. And yes, it kicks the cap can on the road, but you do create immediate cap space. And then you look at a team like the Saints. The Saints are always up against the cap, very tight. And they got players like Mike Thomas, who's a second-round pick. So he doesn't even have the fifth-year option. He's going to get a monster deal. Mike Thomas actually may get more than $20 million, if we're talking about, just because of his youth. His eventual deal may exceed both Julio's and AJ's eventual extensions, but that's a different topic. But to answer your point or question, Jake, they do. I think last year, though, they went into the season at around $9 million or $10 million into the season, and they ended up being, at the end of the season, $7.5 million under. They roll all that over. They always roll. You're allowed to roll every dollar, every cap dollar in unused cap space into the following season under the new CBA. That's how the Browns have rolled over $50 million plus in the last 3 years. But the Bengals, I think last year, rolled over $7.5 million. And so the salary cap this year is 188.2. That's the unadjusted cap. But if you add in the Bengals' $7.5 million rollover, it ends up being around 195. 188 plus 7, it's about 195 and change. So that 195 is their adjusted cap. But yeah, do they take a very conservative approach in terms of we need to have a bigger cushion, so to speak, going into the season? Yes. And I don't fault Paul Daner and I don't fault Jeff Hobson because they're not cap experts by any means, but they justify it, or they write their reasons for justifying it as well. They need to protect against in-season injuries. But the fact is that when you replace a guy for in-season injuries, it's usually a guy on the practice squad. It occasionally may be a street free agent, but even a veteran you pick up off the street is not going to be commanding $5 million or even $2 million. Maybe $1 million, but again, that is prorated since these players are paid over the course of 17 weeks. If a guy gets injured week one and you sign a guy, a street free agent, to a $2 million value, that's not really $2 million. It's 16th, 17th% of $2 million. So it's almost $2 million, but it's not quite the $2 million. But if it's a practice squad guy, he gets on the roster at the minimum salary this year is $495,000. And that's assuming he goes on the roster. I mean, he can't be after week one because he's got an injury. So that's starting in week two, and that's a further reduction. So already two guys there is less than a $1 million cost in net cap cost. And so there are very good, we call cap experts, guys that really follow cap on Twitter. There's Jason from Over the Cap. There's a guy who follows the Texans. His name is Troy Chapman. He's an invaluable follower, and he's actually He's actually the last couple of years tracked the injury replacement cost, and at least for the Texans. I'm not sure if he's done it league wide. And last year for the Texans, who had their fair share of injuries, he mentioned that the cap cost in injury replacements was anywhere between $4 and $4.5 million. So if you want to take that, that's fine. And that's kind of even on the higher end because the Texans had a lot of injuries. You can approach a season with a sizable buffer, but in no way does it need to be upwards of $10 or $12 million necessarily. Now, if you're not going to spend that money, that's fine not to spend it because you don't value your players that way. But my problem is always the justification in not spending it or how it's presented. And the main reason of, well, we have to account for in-season injuries, where the fact is when you're replacing a guy, let's say who gets put on IR after week eight, the replacement player is usually a guy from the practice squad who's now going to account for the next 9 weeks because you have 17 weeks in the season, including the bye week, and players get paid for that. So you have a guy, let's just say, on 9 weeks at a prorated rate of the minimum salary, which for next year will be $495. So $495, let's do the math here. A guy caught up on the practice squad making the minimum next year of $495 is going to account for $262,000 in cap. So you can take that, and let's say that happens for four other guys. That's $1.048 million. For injury replacements. Now, obviously, players get injured at different points of the season, but the point is you don't necessarily need to allocate that much for an injury buffer, so to speak. And then also, you have ways, even though the Bengals don't do this, but if it really got to be a pressing issue where a team was tied up against the cap, then you find a veteran, you pump in some money, you give him money via signing bonus, you convert some of his base salary to a signing bonus, and then you're able to allocate that signing bonus over the remaining years of his deal. And it lowers his cap hit. So there are many ways to create cap space that way too. And so for me, there's frustration when it's justified as, well, they need to save that money for in-season injuries. Yes, of course, you need to save some money. You need to have some buffer. but it doesn't need to be at the levels that have been reported, which quite honestly, what is being reported by the team reporter and the local newspaper reporters is probably not what the actual management is actually budgeting for in-season injuries. They know how much to budget for. Well, it's just not. That it's been right. It's and it's just been reported that way. So that's the way they offer. Now, they also say, well, we need to save that money for rolling over to use for extensions. And that, to me, just kind of you're conflating so many issues, not you, but people are conflating so many cap issues with that, because really the rollover money is not true money. The rollover is just their cap dollars. And again, the cap is really just an accounting mechanism. And so, yes, you can always roll over unlimited amounts. Any cap dollar or cap room you haven't used, you roll it over in the next year. But in no way does it really need to be they say that, well, we need to they'll say it next year. We need to roll it over for the William Jackson eventual extension. Well, the cap is not stagnant. The cap changes year in and year out. It's continually increasing. And then the roster never stays the same, too. Guys will be coming off the books as well. So that justification always gets to me, because it's not truly how a team views it anyway. It's not how teams operate. It's not a cap within the cap. It's just rolled over into a big cap accounting pile, so to speak.
Yep.
And so that's and Jake, I think you and I have had those discussions too. But you know, other teams really don't view it that way. You can get really nuanced into how teams, I think, view it, but the way it's been reported and the justifications given that they need money for the in-season injuries. We just showed that if you're moving up a guy from the practice squad at the minimum salary of $495, and then you prorate that based on the number of weeks he's added to the roster, you can fit five guys in ostensibly under $1 million in cap based on injury replacements, depending on when those injured guys are being injured. Not to get too complicated, for a lot of these bottom roster guys that then go on IR, for example, not the veteran, so to speak, but a guy on a rookie deal. Let's say a late round pick from last year's draft gets injured. Who was a mid round pick?
Auden Tate. Oh wait, mid round.
Yeah, Auden Tate, seventh round pick for 2018. Let's say he makes the final roster, but gets injured after week six. Right, Auden Tate is likely to have what's called a split salary in his contract, meaning that if he goes to IR, his salary will count, but it will count at what's called the down amount, which is a lesser amount. So his cap hit, even though it counts while being on IR, there is a reduction in his cap hit as well. And so for a lot of these guys, it's not just the full amount that gets moved over to IR, because you still have to count for the guys on injured reserve. Their cap hits still count. But a lot of these guys, any guy on a rookie deal that's drafted from probably the third round on, has what's called a split salary in their contract, meaning if they go to IR, their cap hit is going to be much less.
Is it possible that Tyler Boyd had this? Because I noticed this last year when he went on IR, his cap hit went, and there was a little on, I think it was over the cap, had his cap hit number and then a red number below it. And it happened the final 3 weeks when he was on IR.
I would suspect he may have, but Boyd was a second round pick.
Right. And that's why I questioned it.
Yeah, most second round picks probably don't have I haven't seen his contract, but most second round picks likely don't have what's called a split. But I know like Malik Jefferson does. Malik was a third round pick last year. I think he has a split. So for example, if Malik Jefferson, who I hope develops into a fine linebacker, but if he goes on IR at any point next year, he'll have his cap hit will be reduced based on that split contract. So again, the whole point of me saying that, not to get too far in the weeds of split contract, split provisions in a rookie contract, it's just that what's always reported as they need to save this amount of money, $10 million for injury cushions, that's just – it's preposterous. Right. You'll never reach money because, again, most of the guys that are injured, you're replacing them with minimum salary guys, and then you're replacing them at a prorated rate because they're coming in as the season is unfolding.
Yeah. My last question here before we wrap this up, Andre, is the upcoming CBA, and it's on the horizon, a CBA collective bargaining agreement for those that don't know. And what changes should we expect? What kind of fears? I think a lot of people have some fears coming up. But, I mean, rookie deal, rookie wages, how they're going, how the cap is being spent, or at least the 89% for most teams. Should we expect to see a lot of changes in the way that's structured? And how do you feel fear-wise for the football you love maybe potentially being held out?
Yeah, it's a great question. To be brutally honest, I think we're headed towards football Armageddon. I think now whether or not games end up being missed in what would be the 2021 season, I'm not going to go that far. But I will say if a new CBA is agreed upon, it's going to be agreed upon at or around the same time as the last one. And the last one was agreed upon in July. I think it was actually ratified in early August, because that was the year actually that the Bengals, to go on a little side tangent before I address your specific questions, Joe, that was the year the Bengals were actually pretty active in free agency. Because the draft was held before.
I love
and
it.
I've mentioned this on Twitter. I think actually the draft, not just as a Bengals fan, I think the draft should kick off the league year. I think you should have. Now, current players may object to that. The NFLPA may object. But if that's the case, and I'd love to see an analysis done, but if a draft is held before, you can never meet all needs in the draft. So the Bengals in 2011, when the draft was held in that lockout season, were actually fairly active that year. Now, they were minor deals, but they signed a bunch of guys. They signed, like, even Taylor Mays, obviously didn't develop, but they signed a bunch of guys in 2011.
Howard?
Yeah, Thomas Howard, God rest his soul. He's no longer.
God rest his soul.
He's passed, but yeah. Thomas Howard was a signee, Taylor Mays. They had about, I think, five or six guys. And I know they've kind of patted themselves on the back rather hilariously about signing eight guys was the comment.
Yeah.
I mean, I think they included the re-sign one,
yes,
but
they
were actually fairly active with outside guys that year because they had to fill their roster spots and they didn't do it in the draft. But so I do think if a CBA is agreed upon before games are missed, it's going to be at that late in the season. And that was in August. And I remember that season, everybody was worried about that rookie class or the rookies. Oh, how are they going to survive? There's going to be no contribution. That 2011 draft class, by the way, that at least the first round, specifically the first 11 picks, that may go down. All of Famers, but that may go down as the best top 15 draft class of all time. You have surefire Hall of Famers, minus the quarterbacks, actually. Cam was an MVP, but you know, you had Jake Locker, I think, Blaine Gabbert. Those guys flamed out. But, I mean, Tyron Smith, the Hall of Fame left tackle, went number nine.
J.J. Watt.
J.J. Watt.
Von Miller, Julio Jones, Patrick Peterson. It was
Marcel
insane.
Darius. I mean, all the – Von Miller, Hall of Fame players. That's a great class. But I think, Joe, it's – if the NFLPA wants to really move towards guaranteed contracts like their stated goal is, which I don't think they'll ever – but if they want to go down that path, they really have to – at least give the appearance that they're willing to miss games. Baseball did it in 1994. I don't know if you guys are old enough to remember. You guys, they canceled the season mid-season, and it ruined baseball for a little bit. But if you look at baseball salaries, they're fine. I mean, obviously this year the free agent market was depressed. Jake, you probably know this too in free agency for baseball. But baseball players were willing to miss the rest of the season in 1994. They canceled the World Series because they wanted more favorable terms in their collective bargaining agreement, and they got it. And the way they got it was they played hardball. So I'm not advocating for that from the player side. I'm just saying that if the players want to do that or get what they want in this deal, in the new CBA, meaning higher, you know, guaranteed contracts to the extent that they can, shorter lengths for rookie deals, especially removing the fifth-year option for first-round players, because you got a fifth-year option plus the tag, that's 6 years of control for a guy. That even those first-round players who are likely to be the guys that play the most in the league, in other words, maybe even exceed the average, which is 3 years, maybe triple that average, play 9 years in the league, their first 6 years are cost-controlled. And so you want to avoid that. You want to maybe even – there's talk about them reducing the franchise tag, maybe eliminating it. But if nothing else, reducing a team's ability to use it just one time and not the double tag or the triple tag that the Steelers tried to do with Le'Veon last year. But so these are serious issues from the player's perspective that they are getting shortchanged. I mean, we love the game of football, but the truth is we love the game because the players really make it. I mean, we're fans of the Bengals, right? I mean, we love the team, but the players are really what's special. I'm always a fan of the team. I always put the team ahead, but it's really the players are going to make or break it. No, nobody's going to tune in for replacement level players. I mean, I just don't care. No one's going to care for that.
That'll be the year they win it though.
It may. I mean, the way our luck is made, it wouldn't surprise me. But the players really make the league, and literally the players put their lives and limb on the line. So if they want to really get their favorable terms in the next collective bargaining agreement, they're going to at least have to give the appearance that they're willing to miss games. And if they do that, it could get pretty ugly. And I honestly don't see an agreement being reached at the earliest, at the earliest being when the last one was agreed upon, late July, early August. But I would not be shocked if we go into the 2021 season having missed the first couple of weeks of the season. It wouldn't shock me. I hate to paint that picture because we all love this game, and it would be terrible to go in that, you know, the first weekend after Labor Day and not have NFL football around, at least with the players that we know of for throughout the league. But again, if the players really want to get what they want, they're going to have to not blink, because the owners are banking on that. The owners are saying these guys collectively are going to blink, and you're only as strong as your weakest link. And as long as if you get some players, whether they're low end or high end, that are going to break that link in that chain and cave, then you're going to have these guys meeting them on the owner's terms. And so I do think that an agreement ultimately will be reached, and I do think this is my optimistic perspective speaking. I do think it will be agreed upon at the 11th hour before the season starts, but I would not be surprised if we go into the 2021 season if some games are missed. I don't think the whole season will be canceled. I mean, that would be – I don't foresee that. But the owners have to be given at least the appearance that the players are willing to put a lot on the line. And on the line is I'm going to be missing game checks. And the way to get that is in any negotiation is through creating leverage or the appearance of leverage. And that's the way it's going to happen. But to address your specific question, when the CBA is ultimately agreed upon, I think some terms that I think could find common ground from the ownership and players. I think you could find ways to reduce rookie contracts in length, maybe 3 years, maybe even do away with exclusive right free agency, which is a step even below restricted free agency. Exclusive rights players, guys that have an expiring contract but don't have more than 3 accrued seasons. They have, you know, 2 or less. Restricted free agencies are guys or free agents are guys that have not 4 but 3 years and an expiring contract, and then unrestricted it's 4 years. But since the length of a typical NFL career is only 3 years, I think you could make restricted free agency 2 years and unrestricted free agency 3 years. I think that would be a compromise that, I mean, the owners probably wouldn't like that, obviously, but just dealing with the realities of professional football and the shelf life lives of players, I think that could be something that we could see. I think Over the Cap had an article this week about reducing the length of rookie contracts. If you guys want to check that out, it was a pretty good article. But I think also you mentioned that the cap spending requirements right now, the way it's in this current CBA, is teams are required to spend 89% of the cap in cash. We talked about the cap cash distinction. So the way you can easily get to that is just pumping a lot of signing bonuses to giving signing bonuses to players. And that counts towards the cash, even though the cap hit is reduced because you allocate that bonus over the years of the contract. But the way it is now, that's 89% of the cap in cash over a 4-year period. And the first 2 years of the CBA were excluded from that. So years 2011 and 2012 were excluded. And then the 2 4-year periods were 2013 through 2016 and then 2017 through 2020. And we're in the last 2 years of that last 4-year period. I think you can amend the CBA to say it's going to be either a higher percentage of the cap, maybe 95% or 92%, whatever the number is over 89. And then you can make it over a shorter period too. Maybe not over every single year, but maybe over 2 years. And you could further revise it by saying it's going to be based on the team's adjusted cap, not unadjusted cap. Because you have a team like the Cleveland Browns, Jake, you mentioned all their rollover money. Their adjusted cap is well over $220 million, $230 million.
Because unfair advantage.
Yeah, right. So their unadjusted cap is league-wide. That's 188.2. But then added to that, you have their rollover cap of 50-plus million. I mean, you're well into the 130s, if not – or 230s, if not 240. So if you tie the spending based on the each individual team's adjusted cap, obviously that's very advantageous to the players, and the owners may not buy that. But that may be an area where the players really – to get them to sign an extension on the – or a new agreement, that may be an area where the owners kind of give in a little bit. But it does not look pretty overall. I'll wrap it up this way with regard to the CBA questions. It's it's going to be a tough battle for both sides, because both sides are going. The owners, by the way, love this deal. They would extend this deal on its current terms if they could right now. And the NFL is in its glory years in terms of its ratings, and even though they had some ratings concerns last year, but in terms of their revenue, they're at an all-time revenue high, and it's only going to continue. The TV deals are up in a couple of years, and I think that money will be at the same levels, or if not more. And so the owners are swimming in cash, and so the players want to get a bigger slice of that pie. But it's gonna get uglier before it gets better. And those are the terms. I think you make the spending requirements over shorter periods of time, and you increase the percentage to the 90%, somewhere in the 90s, and you base it on the team's adjusted cap room or changes that I could see happening.
Well, thanks for that summary. Hopefully things get resolved. I know Russell Okung is a good player follow too, who's been talking about the CBA quite a bit on Twitter.
Yes.
Andre, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. It's long overdue on my end. I apologize for not joining you guys sooner, but it was my pleasure. Thanks, Jake. Thanks, Joe.
Glad to get you on here. That's Andre. You can find him on Twitter if you want to get his takes on the Bengals spending habits or the CBA or just his Bengals takes in general. You can find him at Andre Parado 13. That's 2 R's, 2 T's in the last name. Go give him a look on Twitter. That'll do it for the Locked On Bengals podcast today. As you probably know, tomorrow is the day that we'll record our mailbag for the weekend mailbag. So in case you need a reminder, make sure you get those questions. And I'm going to re-record this later. I'm just going to stop recording now.
I was going to ask you, Andre.